hates queers, but the church isn't fond of us. What I am, how I feel, is a sin, and I can't repent.
Oh. She chews on that for the rest of the service. Priya wasn't raised in any religion, and she has an outsider's fascination for them, not just the stories and imagery, but the rules and rituals, all the ways we try to structure what people are allowed to believe. When the sanctuary is mostly clear after the service, Edison nods toward the priest.
Go on. We'll wait.
Priya's head tilts to one side.
I thought she couldn't...
Confession isn't the same as counsel, he tells her.
Leaving him to explain the distinctions to Priya and Sterling, I ease out of the pew and up to the altar. Father Brendan is only a couple of years older than me, and he's a good sort. Half the preteen and teen girls have crushes on him, because he's safe, and because he's respectful of their feelings without encouraging them. He's a vast improvement over Father Michael, who used to scowl at me during homilies.
Ah, Mercedes, he greets me, smiling as he hands the last of his regalia to a waiting altar boy.
You've been busy these last few weeks. Which is a nice way of pointing out that I haven't been to Mass in almost a month.
There's been...
How the hell do I even put it? Nodding, he sits down on the edge of the dais, clasping his hands between his knees.
Work? Or personal?
Yes, I answer decisively, sitting down beside him. He laughs, warm and soft, and I need to remember to thank Edison and Priya later for this.
Is everything okay with Siobhan?
She dumped me.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm not sure I am. Sorry, I mean. He listens gravely as I carefully fill him in on what's been happening with the children and Siobhan, even my father. I never told Father Michael, because being a priest doesn't preclude the possibility of being an asshole, but Father Brendan is easy to confide in, and this is far from the first time a case has scraped up against the scars.
That's a lot,
he says eventually, and it makes me snicker.
Maybe it feels like you're besieged on all sides, lost in the woods.
I flinch, but then there's a reason he used that phrase.
These kids, they're being rescued from horrendous situations. It's impossible not to acknowledge that, even as we have to and should abhor the methods. And you wonder what you'd be feeling if someone had made you one of these children, way back when.
When we catch this person, the media coverage is going to be a zoo. A vigilante rescuing kids? The public will eat that up. It makes our job a lot harder to do, and it... I swallow, trying to work my way through that. She's clearly pissed at a system that isn't protecting these kids, but how is dumping them deeper into that same flawed system going to keep them safe?
Those who turn to violence don't usually have solutions to offer. Or they tried and lost and think this is their only way forward.
Something's driving them.
Something drives you, he reminds me. It's probably not all that different.
That's what I'm afraid of. He nods and hums, waiting for me to continue.
I do. Someone who chooses to do this can choose to stop.
Someone who needs to do this.
Someone who can't stop must be stopped. It must be hard to do that if you can see where your lives diverged.
He pauses thoughtfully.
The agent who carried you out of that cabin. Did he do more harm than good?
No, I answer reflexively. He saved me.
And you save others.
What comes after that isn't your fault, Mercedes. Your job demands a great deal of you, but not this. Don't take on more than is yours to bear.
That feels like the end of the conversation, something to mull rather than easily accept. I thank him and stand, dusting off the seat of my pants.
Mercedes.
He gives me a sad smile when I turn to see him better. He hasn't moved to stand.
About your father?
I brace myself.
Give it to God, he says simply.
How you feel about it is yours and yours alone.
Whether or not you should be judged,
that's for God.
It's a lot to think about, and I'm quiet as I rejoin the others and we head back to Vic's house. We take a detour by my home, so I can pick up some more clothing, check the mail, and talk to Jason. He's kept up with the lawn, and he also shows me the cameras he's installed on his porch and mailbox, just like mine.
I haven't seen anyone,
he tells me regretfully.
I've looked.
Thanks, Jason. Listen, my normal phone died, so I'm going to give you my work cell, just in case.
Gotta say, I miss having you around, kid.
Hopefully, this will resolve quickly, and I can come home to stay.
After dinner, Sterling takes me home with her. Whatever timeshare she and Edison planned out, it's fully intact. Rather than making up the couch bed, though, she gives me a gentle push into the bedroom.
Do you really want to be alone right now?
She asks at my token protest.
No.
Knowing what the rest of her apartment looks like, her bedroom is utterly unsurprising, all black and white and blush pink in elegant coordination. A large, light brown teddy bear in an FBI windbreaker sits on the mound of pillows at the head of the bed. I pick it up, touching the black thread nose.
Priya gave that to me when I got the transfer request.
Of course she did. We plug in and situate guns, checking emails and messages one last time before setting the alarms. When we're changed and settled under the fluffy comforter, she doesn't even blink at me cuddling the teddy bear, even though its jacket is whispering with every movement, like the real ones. She just flicks off the light. Noises drift through the walls, her neighbors walking and talking, playing music or games or watching TV. It's not obtrusive, just sort of there, comforting in its own way, like Sterling's steady breathing beside me. Then my phone goes off.
It's only been 2 days, Sterling whispers over the ringtone.
I roll over to grab the phone off the nightstand.
It's Holmes,
I tell her, and answer the call.
What's happened now? 11-year-old Noah Hawken just walked into my police station,
she reports grimly. Is he injured?
Bruised to hell and back, but he swears he's not abused. We're taking him to the hospital now.
I'll be there. The call drops, but the glow of the screen takes longer to dim.
Hospital? Sterling asks, throwing back the blanket to reach for the light.
Yeah.
Sorry.
The smack upside the head, gentle as it is, still takes me by surprise.
Mercedes Ramirez, don't you dare apologize for any of this, she says severely. It is not your fault.
I know that. I do. But I still don't have a response for that right now. We should grab our bags for work. I doubt we'll be getting back before the office. The ER isn't anywhere near as frantic as 2 days ago.
Jesucristo. Dos días.
A nurse at the station recognizes me and points to one of the closed curtains. Sterling stays at the counter to talk to the nurse as I walk over, stepping a little too hard on purpose so the sound can announce my approach. "It's Ramirez," I say. Holmes pulls the curtain back, revealing a pair of calm nurses and a boy sitting on the bed, tear-stained and confused and splashed with blood. He's in an undershirt and boxers, showing a lean, muscled body that's unusual for a boy his age. Holmes was right, though. He's got a lot of bruising, and one of the nurses is bent over a red, swollen ankle. "My name is Mercedes Ramirez," I tell him, and he jerks his head up to look at me. "Someone gave you my name?" He nods slowly.
"She killed my mom,"
he says. His voice sounds slurred, not mushy, so much as drugged, maybe.
"She hit him pretty good on the back of the head when he fought her," Holmes explains, "and he's been having problems with allergies the past few days, so his mom gave him some Benadryl to help him sleep. They'll do a scan for concussion, but they don't want to give him anything for the headache until the Benadryl wears off a bit more."
It's a little scary that Holmes and I have now spent enough time with each other for her to interpret my expressions that well. I lean against the foot of the bed, curling my hands around the plastic frame so he can see them. "Noah, can you tell us what happened?"
"I was sleeping."
He shakes his head, his eyes going momentarily out of focus.
"Mom sent me to bed early, because it's an early morning. We're driving to Williamsburg tomorrow, to Busch Gardens, for my birthday."
"Por amor de Dios, tenga compasión."
"What woke you up?"
Holmes asks. She must have already questioned him a bit before she called and on the way over, but you'd never know it from her face or body language.
"I thought it was a nightmare. One of those creepy mannequins." A hand shook my shoulder. I opened my eyes, and there it was. The hand covered my mouth when I tried to scream.
He mumbles the last bit, a blush creeping up his neck, and there's something perversely reassuring about the self-conscious pride of preteen boys.
"She said I had to be quiet."
"She?"
"Sounded like a she. I mean, I guess it didn't have to be. Like a drag queen or something. Maybe, but,
He blushes a scalding pink.
"I wasn't walking too straight. She put an arm around me, like, to steer me. And she was, soft. You know, like..."
Blushing even more fiercely, he cups a hand against his chest and squeezes. One of the nurses ducks his head to his shoulder to hide his smile. The story is heart-achingly familiar. She took him to his mother's room and forced him to stand beside the bed while she stabbed his mother to death. He fought her, but she pistol-whipped the back of his skull hard enough to make him groggy, and she finished the job, took him to the van or an SUV, he wasn't sure, but it was bigger than his mom's sedan, gave him the bear, and dropped him off one street over from the police station. After, of course, giving him my name.
"She kept saying she was saving me," he says,
his voice small and pained.
"Saving me from what, though? She said my mom had to pay? That she couldn't keep doing this to me." "Doing what?"
Holmes and I trade a look, and she nods for me to take it. "Noah, This person has been going after parents who hurt or endanger their children.
My mom never hurt me, he retorts, straightening so fast he visibly fights off a bout of nausea. She never hurt me.
Noah.
No, we watched those crime shows. I know a lot of kids say that, even though they're being abused, but I'm not.
When you were at a friend's house a couple of weeks ago, someone called Child Protective Services to lodge a concern, Holmes tells him. They said you were badly bruised and limping when you arrived.
My dad was an Olympic gymnast.
His eyes are bright but determined, so rather than derail what seems to be a non sequitur, we stay silent. He won bronze medals for the Netherlands.
When he and my mom got married, they moved here, and he started training gymnasts. He died when I was little.
All I ever wanted was to go to the Olympics, like my dad, but our gym closed 2 years ago.
I wasn't good enough to get into one of the competitive gyms. Last year, I was on the wait list. No spots opened up.
They said if I kept practicing, I could audition again next month.
You practice at home?
Mom converted the basement for me.
We're not rich, though. That's why I was waitlisted, because I have to have a scholarship slot. Our mats are old and the padding isn't great, so I get bruised. I twisted my ankle trying a new beam dismount and...
He blushes again.
I've been trying to get it down for the audition, so I haven't let it heal.
You have to believe me. My mom has never hurt me. All my friends know how hard I practice.
Noah, do you know if someone from CPS came to your home?
Yes, a lady named Martha. We showed her the gym in the basement, and she watched a couple of my practice routines and some of the videos. She said she believed us, and she'd get it taken care of.
He blinks rapidly, trying to keep back tears.
Is that why this lady killed my mom? Because she didn't believe us?
Noah.
Moving around the end of the bed, I sit near enough to offer a hand. He takes it immediately, squeezing punishingly hard. I don't tell him to ease up.
This person, whoever's doing this, she's so caught up in the need to do it that she's rushing, and she isn't getting all the information. I know that can't be easy to hear, and I'm sorry. I am so sorry for what happened to you and your mom.
Why you?
For the first time, I finally feel like I have an answer that's almost good enough. Because whoever she is, she knows I care. She feels like other people aren't paying enough attention to kids being hurt, and my whole job is to find and arrest people who hurt kids. She gave you my name because she knew I would drop everything to be here for you. The tears trickle down his face, smearing the dried blood that hasn't been wiped away.
My mom
loved you. Beyond words, beyond reason, beyond death. She loved you and loves you still. Don't ever forget that, Noah. He nods gravely. Holmes glances down at the notebook in her hand.
Noah, what was your dad's name?
Constantine Hawken, he sniffs. With a J.
Halfway through writing it, Holmes blinks.
Where does the J go?
She asks helplessly. The smiling nurse chokes a little. Turns out the J comes after the I, and there's an alphabet joke in there somewhere,
If I'm brave enough to make it, I'm not. His mother's name is Martya, and when we ask about his grandparents, he shifts uncomfortably on the bed. His father's parents, he explains, didn't think gymnastics was good enough for their son, and they haven't had contact since his father was a teenager. His mother grew up as a ward of the state and never knew her parents. I have the feeling, though, that when the elite gyms he's auditioning with learn his story, he'll find a space and a host family to be his legal guardians. I hesitate to think of it as one good thing, but at least it'll be something. One of the uniformed officers stays with Noah when a doctor comes to take him for a CT. Holmes and I wander out to the waiting room to join Sterling and the newly arrived Cass.
Agent Watts is on her way,
Cass immediately reports to Holmes.
She lives up in Norfolk.
Hell of a commute. That's what, 3 hours each way to work?
Her husband is stationed on the base at Norfolk. She spends the weekends there, cases allowing, and stays with her brother-in-law and his wife on base at Quantico during the week.
Holmes shakes her head.
That sounds exhausting.
She'll be here as soon as she can, but she asked me to come ahead.
Let's fill you in, then.
22. I'm just going to... I hold up my phone, and Holmes nods, focused on the attentive Cass. Sterling follows me to the waiting room, where I can actually make a call without getting scolded.
You believe him, then, that he wasn't abused?
I do, and that's going to be a problem.
That you believe him?
That he wasn't abused.
You want to run that one by me again? We're supposed to be happy when kids aren't abused.
So far as we know, she hasn't killed any innocent people, I tell her quietly.
The waiting room isn't frenzied, but there are a few people there, and our professional clothing is already getting some looks.
I take her by the elbow and lead her outside, a safe distance from the doors, so we don't get in anyone's way.
Mason's father? Paul Jeffers? Maybe. We don't know if he was aware of what his wife was doing.
Probably not, but we'll never know, and I don't think our killer is capable of drawing a line between ignorant and complicit.
Okay.
Zoe and Caleb Jones died, and she's going to take that as not saving them soon enough. She's going to take that on herself, and it's going to make her rage burn even faster and even messier. And when word gets out that Nolan wasn't remotely abused, that she murdered a completely innocent woman who loved and supported her son? Sterling pales in the crappy outdoor lighting.
There have to be hundreds of at-risk kids in this country. We'll have no way to know who she'll go after. There's no way to warn anyone.
She touches the thin gold Star of David at her throat.
Mercedes!
I know. Watts needs to start really digging into the CPS employees. We also need a list of the kids who fit this killer's criteria. Anything that's gone through the Manassas office. I know it's probably a huge list, but we have to have something to work off of.
We're running out of time.
I text Edison and Vic to let them know, hoping they'll sleep through the alerts. There's nothing they can do right now anyway. Still, it's not entirely surprising that not long after we head back inside, Edison walks in with a drink carrier.
It was a gas station,
he says gruffly, handing one to Sterling.
I didn't want to trust the tea. It's hot chocolate.
He is absolutely not awake enough to safely drive. How the hell did he get here? Then he throws away the empty cup in the fourth spot of the carrier and picks up a second cup of jet fuel for himself,
So there's that terrifying answer. He holds the last cup out to me, a mix of hot chocolate and coffee, because they're both shitty at gas stations, but mixed together, they're not half bad, somehow.
If we head to the office, we can keep working on your files, he says, after listening to the full update. Maybe we can find her.
Check with Holmes. She might want me here for when Watts questions Noah. But Noah, when he gets out of CT with the good news of no concussion, is fast asleep and hard to wake, the trauma adding to the Benadryl to knock him out. They wheel him to a room in pediatrics, and he doesn't so much as stir when they shift him to a normal bed. At least they cleaned him up before the scan and changed his clothes. We stand in the doorway and look in. Holmes smiles a little at the sight, something soft and maybe a little wistful.
How far is it to Quantico?
This time of day? About half an hour.
Then go ahead. Watts can call you back if she wants you here for questions.
All right. We'll be at the office for the foreseeable future.
Mercedes.
I turn to look at her more fully. I think I've been in the bureau too long. Hearing my first name from adults makes me start to worry.
Mignone and I have been partners for 5 years. I'm still not convinced he knows my first name, she agrees.
What you said to Noah earlier about why?
It was a good answer.
I keep struggling toward a why, I murmur. I think that's part of it. It's my part of it. I don't think it's all of it.
We'll find out the rest with any luck. But for now, it was the right answer.
We let Cass know we're heading out, and once outside, Edison starts rooting for his keys. Sterling slips her hand into his pocket, yanks out the ring, and shoves them deep in her purse.
Uh-uh, she tells him flatly. You're not driving.
I always drive.
You're not driving.
But I always drive.
And yet, you're not driving.
I bite my lip against a laugh. It's like counting on the tides. Spreading out in the bullpen's conference room, we gradually settle into a system. Edison and I pore over all our team's old cases, skimming over details and notes from the digital files, and whenever a reference to someone, a family member, a neighbor, a hospital worker, a lawyer, a victim, really anyone that makes us look twice, strikes us as interesting, we call out the name for Sterling to research to find out where they are now. It is very quickly a depressing venture. Being a victim isn't something that disappears as soon as you're rescued. It doesn't vanish the moment people who hurt you are taken into custody. That sense of it, that awareness of being not just victimized, but a victim, it sticks to your bones for years, even decades. That sense of the thing can cause as much damage as the original trauma as life goes on. Being a victim has its own nasty form of recidivism. In the days following the destruction of the garden, as girls either succumbed to grievous wounds or began to improve, 13 butterflies survived. Inara, Victoria Bliss, and Ravenna among them. 6 months later, there were only 9. Now there are 7, though to be fair, Marenka died in a car accident. All the rest were lost to suicide, as they struggled to live in a world that was supposed to be better, where they should have been able to leave their trauma behind them. As calm as I tried to be, I understand Inara's worry about Ravenna. Suicide, whether of the original victims or their friends and family, is a common thread through our research. So is drug and alcohol abuse. So is prison. so is continued victimization through domestic violence.
Have you ever given out a bear with wings? Edison asks when we stop for a break.
By which I mean I slammed the laptop shut because I needed 5 fucking minutes without a depressing-as-shit statistic. And he decided that meant time for breakfast. Which actually meant splitting a giant bag of Reese's peanut butter cups.
No, I sigh, forehead against the cool surface of the table. I buy our bears by the gross. They come in a variety of colors, but there are no accessories.
So the angel means something to her, specifically.
The kids have mostly described her looking like an angel, Sterling notes. It could just be something that she took on herself, especially if someone in her family or fosters were religious.
Or a reflection of her name. Angel, Angela, Angelique. Or if she had a brother named Angel, Angelo. I'd say this is a bad time for Yvonne to be on maternity leave, but she'd only yell at us for being this vague.
Why the blonde wig, though? He continues, ignoring me. Even in classical art, angels had hair colors in the full range. They're not all blonde, whatever precious moments would have you believe.
Sterling shrugs and very kindly doesn't comment on his familiarity with precious moments.
Don't look at me. Jewish angels are properly terrifying. Have you ever read those descriptions? There is nothing blonde or pretty about them.
And Jesus wasn't white, but who wants to admit that?
With a deep groan, I open the laptop again.
Okay. Try Heather Grant, I tell Sterling, along with the date of birth and social security number. She went missing in Utah and was found a month later in a field. Said angels had taken her.
And those angels turned out to be an older couple who desperately wanted kids but hadn't been able to have or adopt any of their own. He had a heart attack. She left to get help, and Heather wandered away. She was only calm for interviews if she was in my lap where she could play with my crucifix.
Let's see. She is now 15, doing okay, still lives on the family ranch. Her mother died a few years ago, but her grandmother came out to live on the ranch so she wouldn't be the only female. No red flags.
Sarah Murphy. Edison reads off his screen. She'd be 24 now. The man who kidnapped and kept her for his heaven wife had dozens of sets of wings hanging from the ceiling of his cabin, made out of all kinds of found things. She wouldn't sleep unless Mercedes was in the room.
In jail for assault, Sterling reports after a minute. She escorted a friend to an appointment at an abortion clinic with protesters. One of the protesters tried to hit her friend with a sign. Sarah grabbed the sign and beat him with the 2x4 it was stapled to. She's got another few months.
Huh. You hear jail and you don't expect to be proud by the end of it.
Kara Earitt, I say. She'd be 23 now. And really, what didn't happen to her at home?
Moved around through a lot of foster homes, graduated high school at 17, and falls off the grid. I actually can't find her past that. We'll have to get one of the techs on it when they get in.
Now, you're allowed to say the maternity leave is badly timed, Edison tells me.
I throw a peanut butter cup and hit him just under his eye. Put her on the short list.
She's the fourth name on there, and we're only a year and a half in.
Vic comes in at 7 with actual breakfast and drinks.
How's it going?
He regards us all with grave, worried eyes as he hands out bowls of Western scramble.
Like omelets, but lazier. We've got a few names for the analysts to dig into deeper, I tell him around a yawn. Addison pushes to his feet with a groan and walks around the table to Sterling, standing over her shoulder to pick all the mushrooms out of his bowl and put them in hers. This is going to take forever. He moves on to picking the red peppers out of Sterling's breakfast to put in his bowl. She watches his progress with a bemused, slightly horrified expression. Vic watches too, but chooses not to comment. Do you want to update the Dragon Mother, or would you like me to do it? I'll do it, I sigh. I could stand to move around a bit. Eat first. And then he parks himself in one of the chairs to make sure we do. Once he's satisfied we're not trying to subsist purely on caffeine, he leaves us for his office. It takes a moment to finish my coffee, trying to sort out words and reports so I don't look like an idiot in front of Agent Dern. Eventually, I'm as prepared as I'm going to get and head out into the bullpen. I'm not quite to the elevators when a massive cheer goes out in Blakey's corner of the office, which is a hell of a lot more crowded than it usually is. I can recognize a handful of agents from the cybercrimes division, and there's no division between CC and CAC as agents collapse into hugs on each other, some of them crying, a couple laughing giddily and jumping up and down. Ramirez! Blakey calls. We got Slightly! Slightly, I repeat blankly. Oh, holy shit! Slightly? One of your lost boys! She laughs and throws herself at me in a hug. He's going to be okay. We got him. He's going to be okay. And the bastard who had him gave us leads on Nibs, Tootles, and Curly. I hug her back, holding on just as tightly. They've been tracking these boys and several others for months, trying to break through a ring of pedophiles who use pop-up forums to arrange trades. They found one boy a few weeks ago, but the man holding him panicked and killed him when they closed in on the house. Slightly safe, and solid leads on three others. This is a very good day for Blakey's team and their partner in cybercrimes. But it makes me think of Noah, trying to understand why his mother is gone when she hadn't done anything wrong. I hit the call button, waiting for the elevator, and it opens to frame Siobhan and two of the language experts from the Southeast Asia desks in counterterrorism. After a minute or two, I might even remember their names. But they give each other wide-eyed looks that gradually transfer from me to Siobhan and back again, and step out of the elevator. We'll just... Hey, that looks like a party, the younger one announces awkwardly, and drags her teammate out behind her. What kind of horror stories have you been spreading? I ask dryly, stepping in and hitting the button for internal affairs. Don't have to, Siobhan retorts, voice as stiff as her posture. You really think the whole building doesn't know you're still getting deliveries? None at the house anymore. Really? Really. I study her discreetly in the wavering reflection on the doors. She looks exhausted. Worn in a way that doesn't have anything to do with sleep. It's on the tip of my tongue to ask how she's been in the... Kochamiten? 10 days since I've seen her. It feels so much longer than 10. But I let the silence carry us down the floors. She walked away, and I let her. I'm not sure there's really anything else to say. We hit her floor first, and the doors slide open with a ding. She walks past me, shoulders squared, and hesitates over the tracks,
She turns her head, just barely, like she's going to look back at me. But she doesn't. Someone in the hall calls her name, and she flinches, then walks out without a word or a look. The doors slide shut and leave me alone in the car. I don't have an appointment with the Dragon Mother, so I spend several minutes sitting outside her office while she volubly reminds another agent just how she earned her nickname. Her assistant looks torn between being mortified and proud. I suppose if you're the guardian at the gates for a dragon, you can't help but be pleased when she roars. "Inappropriate conduct with a witness," he murmurs, tossing me an unwrapped pink starburst. "Probably a lawsuit coming. She's not happy." No shit, and so not my business. Christ. A red-faced agent stomps out, sans badge and gun, and after another few minutes, the assistant pokes his head into the lair to announce me.
"Would you like to feel sorry for Agent Simpkins?"
Agent Dern says, instead of hello, when I walk in. If I say I already do?
"She got served with divorce papers 2 weeks ago. Her ex-husband-to-be cited irreconcilable differences stemming from her consistently putting her job above their marriage and family."
"Why are you telling me this, ma'am?"
"Because I know you won't tell anyone outside your team, and you deserve to know that it wasn't you, your team, or your case that sent her round the bend," she says bluntly. "Sit, please."
I sit. She's wearing lilac today, in some kind of fabric that drapes and shimmers becomingly. And I think this is who Sterling should grow up to be. Someone who can wear the pastels and the feminine things without it taking a millimeter of authority away from her. Sterling just has to wait until she doesn't look like jailbait.
"I'm told you haven't seen any of the counselors here."
"I've talked to my priest about everything. I felt like I could be more forthcoming."
"How goes your research through your old cases?"
I run her through the parameters we're using, not shying away from explaining the glacial pace. Because a lot of our search is based on instinct and impression, we can't just turn it over to the technical analysts as is. We have to narrow it down first. She looks back over her pages of notes, written in some ultra-efficient shorthand, possibly known only to her.
"You're still staying with your teammates?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"If you would feel more comfortable at home..." "All due respect, ma'am," I interrupt softly. "It's not about feeling unsafe at my house. I just feel better with Edison and Sterling. Less exposed."
She nods thoughtfully, her dark eyes very aware, in ways I'm not entirely comfortable with.
"Are you going to sell the house?"
"I don't know. I'm honestly not planning to think about it until all this is done."
"That's understandable." "Professional opinion, Agent Ramirez. When do you think this person is going to strike again?"
I take a minute to run back through all the factors and variables that have been hammering away at my skull for hours, days maybe. In the end, though, there's really only one answer. 2 days, if we're lucky. Very likely, less. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who was scared of breaking. Or breaking more. She was honest enough with herself to acknowledge she'd been broken for a very long time. Some of that she'd fixed. Some she was still working on. Some, she knew, could never heal. Even if her body someday gave up the scars, her soul would still carry the wounds. It hurt, every time, to acknowledge she'd never truly be whole. But she did acknowledge it, because some pain was necessary, even healthy. When she rammed against those broken places, when a nightmare was too vivid, when someone touched her in a way too rich with memory, when someone asked her why she hated being in photos, she reminded herself of all the ways she wasn't that little girl anymore. She had a new name, one her daddy and his friends had never touched. She'd gone to college and graduated with honors. She had friends, though she'd left most of them behind when she graduated. But she kept some of them, even after she'd moved, and she was making new ones. She'd moved back to Virginia. She almost hadn't, but it seemed silly to avoid an entire state just because she'd been miserable for so many years. It was hardly the state's fault. And because returning to Virginia was brave, she didn't call herself cowardly for avoiding her old city. That much allowance she would give herself. She had a job she loved and was so proud of it. She was helping people, helping children, children who were like the little girl she used to be. There were lots of things she still wasn't strong enough to do or be, maybe would never be. But this she could do. She could help the children who so desperately needed it, and she didn't have to push herself past the breaking point. And whenever she started to doubt, whenever she felt like she was more scar tissue than real person, she remembered her angel and drew strength from the memory. The teddy bear still sat on her bed, a gift and a kindness. It had seen so many tears from her over the years, but eventually it saw joy as well, and the kind of tears that came of laughing too hard. And she had the angel herself, in a way. She'd been shocked, at first, to see the angel while she was out running errands for her small apartment. She wasn't entirely sure why. After all, even angels had to live somewhere. But it was such a big world. It was a sign, she decided, that she was exactly where she needed to be. She was here, helping children, and her angel was still helping children. She was still an angel. She was healing, and she wasn't as afraid.
23. I'm pretty sure the only thing that keeps Sterling from slipping me sleeping pills is the very real possibility of us getting called in. She is, however, clearly out of all fucks for my fidgets, because she eventually rolls over in bed and knees me right in the ass. Once it hits 2 o'clock, it's like all the tension floods out of me. None of the calls have ever been that late. Early? Despite having set the alarm on my phone for 6:30, I don't wake up till a little after 10. Sterling, already showered and dressed and sitting at her table with the crossword puzzle, just shrugs at my glower.
You needed the sleep. Vic said not to come in until you woke up on your own.
There's only so much I can mutter about that. I mean, I do, because it makes me feel perversely better to grumble about it, like Muttley, but I'm well aware that it doesn't accomplish anything. It takes every trick I've ever learned with concealer to make the shadows under my eyes look vaguely human, and even then, we'll call it a partial success. When I come out, Sterling hands me a bowl of oatmeal, a glass of orange juice, and the front page of the paper. A picture of Noah's mother fills a third of the space above the fold. Constantine Hawken, And it's spelled differently each of the three times it's written, which, come on, paper, is mentioned with his Olympic history and his unexpected death from an aneurysm when Noah was 3. If he'd lived, his son probably would have been in intensive training from a young age, rather than trying to play catch-up from a hobby gym. Marcia Hawken managed a local credit union and volunteered at her son's school one day a week, as well as assisting with a number of PTA events. As a legacy, loving your son and working hard is pretty decent. Below the fold, however, the article mentions the rash of similar murders. It doesn't connect the explosion at the Jones house. The methodology was too different. But it lists the Wilkinses, the Wongs, the Anderses, and the Jefferses, and asks in bold letters if Manassas has our own serial killer.
Comercial mundo, I sigh.
I'm going to assume that whatever you said doesn't require an answer. It's not anything new enough to need one. I check in with Watts, just in case she isn't at the office when we get there, and send her pictures of the more relevant paragraphs of the article. She texts back that the kids in the hospital have been moved to a corner block of rooms with a pair of guards at all times, and an agent has been dispatched to Ronnie Wilkins's grandmother to fill her in and make sure she isn't besieged by the curious or prurient. As soon as we get to the office, Cass pounces and drags me into the conference room, which is still in our setup from yesterday.
We've got the list from CPS, file-by-file access. They're working on identifying the kids in similar circumstances, but it's going to take more time than we have, I think.
They'll forward them in bunches to the Smiths. Edison grunts from the other side of the table and slides me a Chipotle hot chocolate. For the most part, the list is exactly what you'd expect it to be. The social workers and nurses are logged as they follow up on different aspects of each case, and the clerks are the ones who add in paperwork from external sources as it comes into their office. And it makes sense that all the clerks occasionally log into the files to make sure that all forms are accounted for. Is Gloria Hess a supervisor? I ask, spreading out the pages in front of me. She's the only name on every file until this week when Nancy Tate and Derek Lee went through.
She's the senior clerk, answers Cass. It's not technically a supervisory position, though.
So she might train others, but she's not the one who should be going back through to make sure it's done correctly?
Right. Every file?
Every one, and it goes back weeks. A lot of logins, come to think of it, especially for someone too ill to work full-time anymore. Cass leans over the table to grab a folder from the stack at Edison's elbow. He's too absorbed in what's on his tablet screen to even snap at her.
Our analysts dug into Gloria.
The picture on file, copied from the DMV, is pre-cancer, if the hair is any indication. Ashy blonde and thick, bound into a long braid over one shoulder. Her face is fuller, her color better, and all in all, she looks happier, less hollowed. Her husband died a few weeks after her diagnosis, I announce, trailing my finger under words. Dropped dead of a massive heart attack. Absolutely no warning signs or obvious risk.
Who did she piss off upstairs?
Cass shakes her head, her chin digging into my shoulder so she can see rather than pull the file closer.
Advanced cancer, Her husband dies. Her sister and brother-in-law go to prison for abuse. She gets rejected for the care of their kids. Her cancer isn't responding to treatment. It's like some wicked angel put their thumb down and started to squish. But would she be healthy enough to manhandle the kids this way? Ronnie Wilkins was carried to and from the car. She had to half-carry Amelia Anders. She carried Mason. She half-carried Noah.
Not the others?
No. She used Sammy to keep Sarah and Ashley compliant, Zoe for Caleb and Brayden. They weren't going to fight her when she could hurt the youngest.
I feel like there's something really important no one's brought up yet, and I'm not sure there's a good way to do it.
Why are all the kids white? Sterling offers, not looking away from her laptop.
Okay, so it has been brought up.
Not really. It's just the obvious question. All of the families, with the partial exception of the Wongs, have been white. Generally argues that the killer is white as well.
This type of mission as a whole argues a white killer, I remind her. And you're forgetting the racism inherent in the system.
Sterling nods, but Cass looks between us in confusion.
Applying how?
Minority kids are significantly more likely to be taken from their families on less documented cause, and less likely to be given back to their families without more oversight on the parents. They take minority kids for the good of the kids, but leave the white ones for the good of the family. Minority kids are more likely to get treated poorly in foster homes, but this killer is going after the parents thus far, not the fosters. So they're going after the white parents who get their kids back against evidence. At the silence from my shoulder, I tilt my head to see Cass frowning.
What?
You didn't even have to think about that one.
It's well documented. We get taken faster, and it's harder to get us back.
Were any of the kids' files accessed by Gloria the day of the murders?
I lift Gloria's file to check the papers below.
All of them.
Cass pushes back from the table, phone already in her hand.
Burnside, she says on her way out the door. This is Kearney. I need to know what files Gloria Hess has accessed most recently. Check Derek Lee as well, just in case.
I wonder if there's a way to borrow an administrator from a CPS office in another county to oversee a more detailed audit. After all, if Lee is in charge of the clerks, he might know their logins. As much as we're all thinking she, Lee hasn't been eliminated as a possible suspect. My cell goes off, but it's a number on the bureau exchange, so the ringing doesn't cause the same frisson of fear it's come to impart recently.
Agent Ramirez.
Agent, this is the front desk. You have a visitor down here.
A visitor?
Sterling and Edison both look up, but I shrug.
Her ID says Margarita Ramirez.
Cógeme. My phone buzzes with another call, and I pull away from the screen to see Holmes's name.
I've got a call about a case coming in. Tell her I'll be down soon. Have her sit tight.
Without waiting for an answer, I switch over. Ramirez.
A pharmacist at Prince William took a smoke break and found 12-year-old Ava Levine asleep on a park bench. She had two angel bears.
Blood?
No. I'll grab Watts and Kearney and come down. I really want to throw this fucking phone against the wall. It does not bring good things. Ending the call, I take a deep breath and consider my options.
I have to head to Manassas, I tell my partners. Girl was found sleeping outside the hospital.
Sleeping? Like she was drugged?
I don't know. I'll tell Vic.
What about your visitor? Sterling asks.
Also, Vic.
Before I can be tempted into explaining